You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello.
Welcome. My name's Mark Shaler. I'm an eco-designer, about 25 years experience, and I'm chairing this evening. I've got some really bad news, I'm afraid. George Monbiot had to pull out at 5 o'clock this evening due to a personal... I think he said personal crisis, which sounds really, really grave, hopefully not too grave. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the event tonight. And just a reminder that this event tonight forms part of the RSA's annual free programme of talks, debates and screenings, all of which are made possible by the support of the fellows, some of which are here, and to the generosity of partners and supporters such as the Tyndale family, who are supporting this event this evening and some drinks afterwards. And this is the second in a new series of lectures supported by the Tyndale legacy. Now, I guess you'll all be design or design-related individuals, and you'll all have some idea of environmental issues, and you'll all have some idea of sustainability. Horrible, horrible word, but I guess that's in all of you, yeah? Anyone in the wrong room? No? Fantastic. I wanted just to start us off a little by talking about some of the kind of inherent problems within society in terms of design and in terms of the economy. And we've called this redesigning the future. Now, I've got four children. I know, that's really bad of me and not sustainable at all. But I spend quite a lot of time wondering about the future and quite a lot of time worrying about the future. And it sometimes feels like the future's a little bit broken. Like, I'm at a party and the party's going on in another room, and it feels like the future's maybe happening to other people in other parts of the world. And maybe in the UK, the future isn't really what we expected it to be. And I want you to think about why that went wrong, because it wasn't always like that. Those of us, like me, that grew up in the 60s and 70s, the future was here and now, and it was just brilliant. It doesn't maybe feel like that now. I may have got this wrong, but that's how it looks to me. And I want you to go back into the past to look at the future. I want you to think about the way that Karl Marx defined production, as a way of looking at some of these issues. And his standard equation is raw materials plus labour equals product plus waste plus profit. We're all aware of that, the means of production equation. And I thought if I take each of those in turn and just look at where design has fitted in and where things have changed, it might just give us a few clues and set the whole scene. So starting off with raw materials, we're running out of raw materials, or of some raw materials, things like indium. You know, we're down to kind of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years. It depends who you talk to, and there's a lot of debate about how many years of these things there are. I appreciate that. But we're running out of these things, which means the end of cheap materials has gone. Now, prices are therefore unstable, and ownership of raw materials will determine future economic wealth. If you don't own things, you can't make stuff. And who owns most of the raw materials in the world at the moment? This is an interactive part of the evening. China. China control over 95% of all rare earths. That's staggering. China control most of Eastern Africa, because that's where the raw materials come from. So if you add geopolitics into scarcity, then we've got a bit of a recipe for disaster. We've kind of given birth to what I call a new colonialism. And it's not like the old colonialism. It's very much more giving. But control of resources is absolutely essential. So raw materials have changed massively over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Labour, that's the next part of the equation. Chasing cheap labour around the globe, that's pretty much finished. Or we've gone to peak labour. We talk about peak oil, peak labour. Cost of production rises as labour prices rise. Cheap labour becomes the new middle class. We've got about 2 billion people moving from working to middle class before 2030. That's massive. These aren't the new middle classes. These are the new spending classes. These are the new consuming classes. If any of you have read Harry Wallop's book, Consumed, I don't know if any of you have read that, it redefines class by, rather than where our money comes from, where it goes to. It's a really interesting assessment of how we spend our money. And that money often goes to product, which is on the first side of the other equation. And we have more products and more stuff than we've ever had. We have double the amount of products than we had in the mid-1970s. But we're no happier for these things. So you just, if any of you read 100 Things, Dave Bruno. No, I can heartily recommend it. This is a geezer in the States who decided enough was enough. He had too many things. And he'd try and get down to 100 items in his life. And I read this book, and then I was off for work somewhere. And I thought, I'll just tot it up. I was driving probably up the M6 and thinking, what's in my car? And I had my Thai boxing kit and my running kit and my work stuff. And a quick tot up made me realise I had more than 100 things in my car. That's wrong. I didn't even count the car. So to have 100 things in your life is a real challenge. It's a very good book, well worth a read. And we own more stuff. And we've become really lazy at describing who we are. And we use ownership of things to define us increasingly. And we're emotionally attached to things that are actually functional. So, and we're going to hear loads more about this later. So we've got this definition by ownership, and more importantly by the speed that we adopt the new. So the way that we own products has changed, and what they do for us has changed hugely. So that's the first part of the other side of the equation. And then we've got waste. Well, it's not waste, is it, anymore? We're now pretty smart. We know that waste is resource in the wrong place. A good friend of mine, Mike Pitt, says, we have the periodic table in our hands and we let it slip through our fingers. And we put it in our bins, and that's just bonkers. Old waste solutions are really expensive. New ones produce income. So increasingly, we're looking at redefining that part of the equation. And that just leaves us with profit. And profit's really interesting because it sits in the hands of the few. It sits in the hands of the 1%, not in the hands of the 99%. And equity is missing from profit in all senses of the word. Equity is missing from that. So if we look at that Marxist equation of production, everything's changed. A huge amount of stuff has shifted. And we're running out of things and we're consuming arguably too much. Or we're consuming too much when we don't have a circular economy, because actually the quality of life and health benefits that come with growing nations aren't necessarily bad things at all. We just need to be able to close the loop. And so this madness, this illness, this huge consumption is only going to increase as the East grows and becomes wealthier. And why would the East make for us when they have this huge amount of growth themselves? So we have to, in the UK, we have to start manufacturing again. And we have to develop a circular economy, which is what we're going to talk about. We need to value longevity. We need to value potentially leasing. We need to remodel consumption. And the debate tonight will highlight some of the core issues surrounding moving to a circular economy, outline the work that some of the speakers have been doing, and hopefully stimulate a discussion that will begin to change things. And one of the outputs we'd really like from you is we'd really like three things that the RSA can do at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we'd talk all the time about this sort of stuff. But what can we do? What can we go away? So we'd really like you to write three things down, voice them in the discussion, or if you're a bit embarrassed, slip them to me at the end surreptitiously. And we'll try and go away and do those things. So all the official stuff finished with now. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speakers tonight. We've got Nat Hunter, who's co-director of the RSA Design and Great Recovery Project. Jonathan Chapman, Professor of Sustainable Design at Brighton University over on the left. And Rich Gilbert, on my immediate left, co-founder of Sustainable Design Consultancy, the Agency of Design. I'd like that to be called the Age of Design. It's too late. We should drop a bit. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming our first panellist, Nat Hunter.
Thank you, Mark. In the design department here at the RSA, we're looking at the it's not design in the traditional sense, it's the bleeding edge of design. It's new ideas in the design world, how design affects our future. We're responsible for the Royal Designers for Industry, a Lifetime Achievement Award for Design Excellence and Significant Benefit to Society. We also have the oldest student design awards in the UK, 90 years next year, awards which direct students towards applying what they've learned about design to making our world a better place. They're really, really fantastic. Check them out online. We also run projects, and our major projects for the last 7 months is one called The Great Recovery, and that's what we're here to discuss tonight. So the Great Recovery is firstly investigating the role of the designer in moving us from a linear economy to a circular economy. And secondly, it's actually making that change happen. A linear economy is when you dig resources up out of the ground. So as Mark was talking about digging up coltan in the Congo, you then make it into something, and within 6 months we throw away 90% of things that we buy, and we put them in a hole in the ground called landfill. It's a crazy system. A circular economy, on the other hand, it mimics nature's cycles, and it demands us to think about systems. The idea is that nothing gets thrown away, and there is no such thing as waste. If you make things in the right way, then their constituent parts can all be reused. It's a much more sensible model for so many reasons. So looking at this problem, we realised that there are many different people who need to work together. It's not just designers. It's consumers. It's the people who actually run the resource recovery and recycling centres. It's the brands who commission the design. It's the material experts. It's the policy makers. If you picked up one of our newspapers on the way in, and if you didn't, please pick one up on the way out, there's a very nice diagram on page 10 of all the people that we've identified as being part of the problem. So one key goal for us is to take people out of their silos and get people to talk to each other about these issues. So for the last 7 months, we've been taking mixed groups from these different areas of experts to recovery centres. We've been to see textiles, e-waste, plastic and engines, and we've been to see them be refurbished, reused, recycled or recovered. When we've been there, Mark Shaler here has been helping us run workshops where we take objects apart, we see what's in them and how easy or difficult it is to recover the constituent parts. It's been a very powerful process. There's something about when you take people out of their normal environment and you connect them with people they wouldn't normally be talking to, that mix enables people to start thinking in a completely different way. So the main drivers for this project are financial. We've not used the words sustainable, eco or green anywhere. And Mark's touched on this already, but the first driver is the rising cost of materials. The cost of copper has tripled in the past 3 years. We've all been affected by the theft of roofs and cables. The second driver is, as Mark mentioned, resource security. China now owns 97% of the rare earth market, and that is a massive security issue for us here in the UK. So that's the problem. What's the solution? We've identified four key ways that designers can work with others to make real behaviour change. So the first model that we've identified is designing for longevity. So this is about designing products that last, well-made, well-crafted products that you don't want or need to throw away. And when they break, you'll know or can find out how to fix them. You can take them apart easily without breaking security seals. This model encourages the growing culture of repair and fixing. Why throw something away when you could easily fix it? The second is design for service. Now, this is one of the most interesting. So new digital platforms and changing consumer behaviour are allowing us to share and lease products rather than owning or buying. Car sharing, for instance, Zipcar, is now common and it's an accepted practice. And this model will soon roll out to other products. So I don't own a car, I use Zipcar, and by using Zipcar rather than owning a car, that keeps 8 cars off the road. Service design could be a real game changer. According to the 2012 report Towards the Circular Economy by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, high-end washing machines would be accessible for most households if they were leased instead of sold. Customers would save roughly a third per wash cycle, and the manufacturer would earn roughly a third more in profits. So why aren't we doing it? Number three is design for reuse and manufacture. So the cost of remanufacturing mobile phones could be reduced by 50% per device if the industry made phones easier to take apart and offered incentives to return phones. So designers need to work much more closely with manufacturers to see where that opportunity lies. Current obstacles lie in legislation, where a product with a remanufactured part cannot currently be sold as new. How crazy is that? The last of the four design models is design for material recovery. So at we've been going around visiting loads of different places, and at Recycling Lives in Preston, we saw these two TVs were lying ready to be disassembled, and they were both LCD TVs, and they have to be disassembled by hand because you can't crush them because they've got mercury tubes in the back. And there was a Philips TV, about that big, and a Samsung TV sitting next to each other. And the Philips TV had 300 screws in the back, and every single screw had a different screw head. And the Samsung TV sitting next to it looked identical to me, to the naked eye. It had 150 screws, so half the number of screws. And it was exactly the same screw head all the way through, ironically, a Philips screw head. So the Samsung one was much easier to take apart. And the lesson from this is if you know your product's going to have a short lifespan, like TVs do these days, then design for disassembly. So these models can't be designed for in isolation. If you design for recovery, you need to design with a recovery expert. If you want to capture as many resources as possible at the recycling stage, then you need to know what's valuable and why. This means that you need a chemist and a material scientist sitting next to you. You probably also need someone who understands resource scarcity and business models. It's hard to make people change their behaviour. We felt that we needed an incentive, a carrot instead of a stick. So we teamed up with the Technology Strategy Board to support their competition, which was called New Designs for a Circular Economy. And it was giving away £1.25 million in as prizes for feasibility studies. And the competition's attracted entrants from all sorts of industries. The first round of winners was announced in February, and the entries span from huge companies like ICI, looking at the life cycle of paint, like all the cans of paint we've all got in our garage, you know, what do we do with that, through creating a remanufacturing process for electric vehicle batteries, plastic bottle recycling, the plastic lids on plastic bottles. There's a feasibility study happening to see whether they can make them into the same plastic so that it's easier to recycle, saving 100,000 tonnes of plastic every year. And at the other end of the scale, small design consultancies like Agency of Design, and we'll hear from Rich Gilbert later, and he's one of the designers who is inspired by this programme. Each winner was awarded £25,000 in the first instance, and that's not a huge amount for a large company, but it's been enough of a carrot to tip people into action. If they're half thinking about doing something, just having a focus of a competition and money seems to have been enough to bring people out of the woodwork. Companies have to collaborate in order to enter, which means that people are emerging from their silos and starting to partner with people that they're not accustomed to partnering with. And we've had really good cases of designers banging on companies' doors and, you know, attracting attention with this competition. And it's important to show that government is behind this kind of innovation. So to sum up, we're looking at the future of design and manufacturing, how we'll make things in a resource-scarce future. We're building a UK community to drive forward the circular economy, to bring people out of their silos and to create better connection, to encourage transparency and to deliver clearer information about how our products are made. We're rewarding solution-focused thinking and empowering designers to make actual change to business models in the real world. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take questions all together at the end, obviously, hence the term discussion. Straight away on to Jonathan Chapman.
Thank you. What I'd like to say is that you could actually look at the sustainability crisis as a crisis of perception, and not just one of energy and materials alone. You could say that it's as much to do with the human condition as it is to do with plastics, metals, and CO2. And of course, it's about all these things. But much of my research and consultancy and writing and teaching actually engages with the psychological phenomena that shape patterns of consumption and waste. And I suppose a simple way to say that again is I try to understand why people keep certain things and not other things, where meaning comes from, why certain objects become quite meaningful. how attachments form, how attachments break, those kinds of things. And through that, I attempt to create design tools and methods and frameworks that build resilience into relationships between people and their products, as a way to extend product life, but also as a way to reduce waste. And I call this approach emotionally durable design, which is one of a number of approaches. I'm sure this panel could have 50 members on it, and we still wouldn't cover the range of possible approaches to this fascinating subject. But that's the approach that I take. Now, when we talk about waste and why people throw things away, and you know, that kind of rapid, ever more rapid discarding of things, often we think, well, it's planned obsolescence. You know, it's that kind of death dating, as it's sometimes called, of goods. And now I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with the idea of planned obsolescence, and I'll try and help to explain why. And I suppose it comes to, you know, thinking back to when I was just perhaps a bit more angry about this, looking at waste and really wondering why. You know, landfill sites, which I used to consider to be graveyards for products, if you actually mine a landfill site, which I have, you'll find that it's not a graveyard at all, because most of the stuff in there still works just fine. It's more of an orphanage, I suppose. It's more of a, I shouldn't be laughing, you know, it's more of a kind of a home for unwanted things. And I think that's really, whilst it's grave and quite serious, I also think it's really interesting in terms of just design. I mean, you know, why are some things important to us and not others? That's a discussion that any designer should be interested in, never mind whether you care about the environment or not. I mean, that's essentially what design's all about, creating meaning, you know, in the world. So this love-hate relationship with planned obsolescence, I began a course of design research which led me to discover that, you know, quite quickly, that the term planned obsolescence comes from a guy called Bernard London in 1932, who wrote a paper called Ending the Depression Through Planned Obsolescence, which was presented at a US economics conference. Now, the intention of this vision, you know, planned obsolescence, was essentially about trying to get people who already had everything they needed, the very small 1%, who had money, who had things at that time in the Great Depression in the US. It was about trying to get them to buy more things, to get production going, to create work for people, to create money. And in the 30s, in the States, it was this grave situation, people dying of starvation. It was, I mean, you know, it was a very significantly bad moment in history. And so an economist had an idea that would change that. And based on the information that person had at that time in the 30s, I could say, well, actually, that's a pretty good idea, isn't it? You know, and I think a lot of us would say that, you know, designing and creating, creating solutions to social problems, sometimes we call it social innovation now, you know, that's a very relevant thing to do. So based on the information Bernard London had at the time, planned obsolescence, brilliant idea. I think the only problem is that we've learned quite a bit since then. So planned obsolescence, perhaps not such a good idea today, because we know a little bit more about the consequences of ever more rapid production and disposal of things. So for me, that was an important realization, because it kind of allows me to not blame and get angry about things. And one of the things that I find holds a lot of would-be sustainable designers back and prevents people from engaging is that they feel that too angry, or that it's a kind of burden to carry, you know, the sins or the ills of people who have come before them. But I really feel very few people would consciously wake up one morning and say, I'm going to really do some ecological damage today. You know, I'm going to go to work and I'm really going to mess things up. It might be that there are various levels of concern about one's impact on the world, and there might be negligence, and we could talk about that a great deal. But I think that deliberate destruction, I'm not sure. I think there's a debate to be had about that. So in that sense, planned obsolescence, I think things have maybe shifted since then. In fact, we were talking earlier that maybe it's better to actually plan the date at which something starts to come to an end so that we can prepare for that. So moving on from planned obsolescence, I'd like to say that I think design is in between stories. So thankfully, we're moving from this doom and gloom rhetoric, this kind of tired rhetoric of guilt and fear-mongering, and we're moving to a new story of opportunity and entrepreneurship and possibility and kind of hope, I suppose. So actually, this is a really fantastic time to be engaged in sustainable design, because the story has moved on. And the thing that moves the pages of that story on faster are actually good ideas and solutions and possibilities, because actually very little positive change occurs from finger pointing and criticism. So I guess to conclude, I would say that design is in an incredibly powerful location in order to facilitate change, to instigate and seed change. Design is in a powerful location to prospect and look for opportunities for things to happen. Design is a space where things can change, because after all, design has always been about change and reinvention. So I can't think of a more powerful field to engage with the sustainability crisis.
Brilliant. Thank you. And on to Rich.
Thanks. My name is Rich. I set up a small company called the Agency of Design with a couple of like-minded designers. We actually all met at the Royal College of Art, and the first project we did together was all about closed-loop design strategies, so kind of ideas of a circular economy and closed-loop are quite kind of close to the heart of our thinking. That was 4 or 5 years ago now. We've kind of worked in a range of different sustainable design areas. But we're just coming back to the world of closed loop. We're starting 2 technology strategy board feasibility studies into closed loop products. So spending the next 6 months thinking about kettles and light bulbs. And quite exciting to be back in the area. I was asked to kind of highlight some problems and opportunities of sustainable design, moving towards sustainable design. And I just wanted to highlight one point, really. It's kind of a story from our first inquiry into closed-loop design. And it's really about making sure you design the right thing, or try and redesign the right thing. And when we were first kind of tackling the world of closed-loop design, we've been reading a lot about industrial ecology and these kind of ideas of industrial symbiosis and how you can more intelligently use waste. It seemed like an area kind of full of exciting ideas, and none of that was really being applied to kind of commercial products. And we were kind of a group of product designers and engineers, and we were like, well, this is an easy pickings. We'll take some of these fantastic ideas and we'll put them into products, and there'll be some sort of physical redesign, and we'll create something fantastic. So we went off kind of delving into the world of of closed loop and of kind of researching what happens in our existing system, because there is a kind of in theory a closed loop system exists in the UK already. We were specifically looking at electrical items, so anything with a kind of a plug on it or battery in it, because that has the kind of they have the more interesting materials embedded inside them, and they're all covered by the WEEE legislation. So everything that gets sold onto the market in the UK has to be taken to an approved processing plant. It has to be disassembled and materials kind of get sold off and reprocessed. So we went along, and this is essentially what Mark's now doing with lots of the other great recovery applicants. So we went down to a waste processing facility. It's the place where most of the electrical waste from London gets taken. And it was a really kind of eye-opening trip, because as Jonathan touched on, there's just a kind of a mountain of dead products. And it is quite emotional as a product designer, because these are things that maybe they stopped functioning, but they've probably stopped functioning for quite a minor reason, and all things that people just kind of aren't fashionable anymore. So lots of things in kind of weird colour schemes all piled up together. But the bit that was really striking about the trip was looking at the disassembly process. So this happens in various different ways. So some things are disassembled by hand, but we were kind of interested in the smaller stuff. What happens to your kind of your toasters and your hoovers and your kettles and all that sort of stuff. And they get shredded, or they get put in a big drum and a chain swings around to smash them apart. So the kind of disassembly process, the output is lots of tiny bits of product. So that works quite well for things like metals, but then all the kind of plastics all get mixed together and you get kind of broken up circuit boards. And I just found the whole process kind of bizarre, because I came from an industrial design background. I was quite used to the kind of the intelligence and the finesse that we put into assembling products, and there's kind of an awful lot of kind of human exertion goes into designing a product quite carefully, and we absolutely optimize that process of putting something together so it happens really quickly, and then when we take it apart we just kind of get the products and smash them together, and it seemed kind of bizarrely crude to me. So I was kind of questioning, why is this happening? Why have we not got better disassembly processes? Because surely we could make much better material flows. There'd be lots of benefit to it. And I suppose the long story short, the crux of that problem was that there's just no connection with the manufacturers making the products and the people processing that waste material. So if I was to take my kettle or my toaster and I was to kind of standardize the fixings, maybe I change the design and I make sure it's kind of easy to take apart, so that then tell all the waste processors that they can use this set process. Well, I've kind of probably made a bit of money for the waste processors, because they can get better materials out of it, but actually it's just cost me quite a lot and I don't get any benefit from it. So at this point in the project, we were kind of, having been kind of fairly ambitious about changing the world, it got a bit despondent, because, what do? You design something to be shredded better? It didn't feel like a very ambitious design goal. So we kind of slightly back to the drawing board. And we then went and visited a company called Orange Box, who make office chairs. They're in South Wales, a really interesting bunch of guys. And they had quite an interesting story, because they sell kind of business to business, so they go and sell a few hundred office chairs at a time to big companies, and they started taking back the old product. So they take back their old chairs, but also other people's chairs as well. So they had this kind of pile of old office chairs. So they employed someone to start separating the materials and recycling them. And that process involved a kind of crowbar and an angle grinder, some giant kind of scissors. And they quickly realized that it was taking at least an hour to separate these materials, and all the kind of the potential value in them was getting kind of wiped out by the labor cost of this chap kind of ripping them all apart by hand. And they showed us that their next kind of generation of chair had all these kind of really nice little design features in it. Everything just kind of pulled apart by hand. They had lots of really intelligent stuff with, they got rid of co-molded polymers, and they'd kind of done some quite clever things with shore hardness of elastomers. And all the kind of, what we were thinking, this is the sort of stuff that we were going to be designing, so these kind of intelligent disassembly features. And what we realized, we kind of come to the project in the wrong mindset. that this wasn't about thinking about the products themselves. This was the design challenge was much more systemic. It was how do you connect a manufacturer with the value in the waste materials in their products. So it wasn't necessarily these design features. It was the fact that they'd started taking their product back, and they could then see it was very obvious. All these kind of questions of efficiency of assembly all start to happen automatically. Yeah, if I take my own product back, then I suddenly have this drive to innovate and come up with lots of clever ways to disassemble my product. And none of that kind of exists when you have a kind of a broken system. So my sort of point on problems and opportunities is that this is a kind of, you could have easily missed the mark and designed something that actually quite a few of them might have gone through a shredder. And really the design challenge was in the kind of the services and the systems and the logistics of getting the product to the right place. And making sure that really that's the critical part, then everything else will just kind of happen naturally.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Okay, that was ace. We've covered some ground there, emotional design, disassembly, and then linking up all the people in the wheel. I think you called them parts of the problem, which I really liked, actually. I've long said that design is the single most powerful environmental tool that there is. Undoubtedly, it is. I'm left wondering why it's still being misused and how we can stop it. And I'm going to start the questions rolling, because that is my prerogative, by asking the panel, why has design been misused and how can we harness it for good?
I suppose it's been misused and it hasn't in a way. You know, I think you could say that through design we've actually achieved a huge amount. And as our kind of awareness and mindfulness of the impact of our actions on other people, on ecology, as our awareness continues to evolve, then we reflect on what we've done and we critique it. And you know, my feeling is that actually we've achieved a huge amount through design, and the design story is, as I say, an evolving, changing story. But I do think that it's perhaps a story that's lost its way a little bit, and perhaps become a bit too subservient to the notion of economic growth. So perhaps design is seen as a means to generate economic growth, you know, as a priority beyond any other. Now, that's not to say that economic growth, or at least some form of economic stability, isn't relevant. I think, of course, it's absolutely relevant. You know, as I sit here in my comfortable chair enjoying electric lighting, of course it's relevant. But it's surely there is a balance to be struck between various other factors as well. I think a lot of what the sustainable design drive is trying to do is to perhaps question what those other factors are, you know, culture, people, place, and so on, and to perhaps try and rewrite them into the story in a way that perhaps restores some kind of balance.
Brilliant. Thank you, Rich.
Why is design misused? I suppose it does what you touched on at the start, Jonathan. It's design post-1930s, which everything was very functional pre then, and then as we did become a bit of a tool for growth. And I suppose the upshot of that is that we got very good at making things desirable, and we just became really good at making things sexy and making them sell, which, you know, that's not a bad skill to have. You can go through sort of design education and you can seduce people into purchasing things.
So that's designed to manipulate want rather than to solve a problem.
It is, yeah. Just to sort of evolving that question of planned obsolescence, and I suppose when you think about the misuse of design, it's in that facet that you think, well, you know, should we not be focusing our attention to better things? But still, you know, those skills are still relevant in making things desirable and kind of. Jonathan's philosophy on emotionally durable, that all those things are kind of how you create a connection with people are really relevant. It's just how we kind of redirect that focus. So it's less about kind of sales, and it's how we how we reconsider growth, that actually there's lots of design opportunities for achieving growth that can kind of decouple growth from material throughput, and all these kind of ideas around the circular economy are really elegant ways of doing that. But ultimately, we come back to the question of the financials of this, that they still need to be products that people want, and they have to be desirable, and they're kind of, we have developed that skill set, and we need to not leave it behind. They still need to be products that people love and kind of have an attachment to, but it's kind of diverting us a little bit more to the circular approach.
And that satisfies societal needs and medical, all of the things that design has solved for us.
Yes, and some of the areas that Nat touched on, the whole question around service and leasing and kind of changing perceptions of ownership is really interesting, because they're really quite different design challenges that suddenly, it's not this kind of a manufacturer making a product and there you go, it's out in the world, it's yours now, you take care of it. It's kind of, you now have this kind of ongoing dialogue with the manufacturer, which is a kind of, for a lot of product areas, that's a kind of a brave new world. And it's, and I think there's lots of very positive motivations there that from a customer's point of view, I'm going to be very demanding about the kind of level of service that I'd expect from that. So I think they're all interesting design challenges, but they're kind of pushing design in the right direction.
Brilliant. Thank you. Nat?
Well, I've got two thoughts. One is that in a lot of design courses, sustainability is still seen as an add-on. So I've been in several art colleges over the last few months where they have Green Week or Eco Week. I just think, why are we still having that conversation? Why isn't it embedded into everything that we do? I mean, why is it even an option that it's separate? I was talking to the course leader at Innovation Design Engineering, which I think is the course that you did, isn't it? At the Royal College of Art. And I think more recently than you doing it, their innovation was to embed sustainability as a matriculation criteria. So in order to matriculate, you have to have ticked the sustainability box, and there's various kind of subsections of that. But they said that ever since they did that, which I think is about 2 or 3 years ago, the work's completely transformed, because there isn't even a debate about it. So that's my first thought, that it shouldn't be an add-on. That goes for the rest of us in as consumers as well. Sustainability shouldn't be seen as an add-on. We shouldn't have separate sustainable or eco products. The second thought is about the complexities of actually commissioning design. So in the last few months of finding things out in the Great Recovery, we've discovered that quite a lot of large companies, very large companies, who have excellent sustainability kind of vision at the very top of the company, what's happening is that there'll be someone in the marketing department who ends up commissioning the design, and that someone in the marketing department isn't as on board as the CEO of the company. They don't really know what it means, so they don't commission they don't write very good briefs. And then the 100 designers or so who are on the roster, there's been no particular criteria to get on the roster, so there's no one who's had any kind of circular economy or sustainable educational experience getting on that roster. So you have a very kind of poor brief being given to designers who aren't really equipped to question that brief. And that's why quite a lot of bad products still get made by companies who are saying that they're trying to move in a more sustainable direction.
That's interesting. So we're not equipping our designers with the relevant skills, mm-hmm. and we're not getting the right people setting the briefs. Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic. I'm going to open it up to the floor now.
Hi. It strikes me that a lot of the problems with sustainable design are communication-related, and you've just described a really good example. The people in those companies that are commissioning designs are not communicating properly. But really my question is, how can the design community come together to communicate with open source? Is there an opportunity to create a Wikipedia-like resource that says, this is how we created something that is sustainable, learn from it, use it?
Great question. Brilliant. And we live in, we live in an open source world, and it's only going to get more open and more shared. Okay. Would you like to answer that first, Rich?
Sure. It's a question of kind of collective learning. And to some extent, that does happen. There's kind of as a kind of avid blog reader, I suppose, you always pick out kind of interesting case studies of what people have done in terms of product development and in terms of kind of, you know, how they've tackled sustainability problems. You're right, there's no kind of central resource. You have to kind of pick those snippets up wherever you can. I suppose there's an interesting question of kind of openness there and sort of innovation and new ideas in the sustainable area. There's still kind of people are still slightly closed about them. This is a very tricky question of, you know, well, I'm careful about my intellectual property and kind of the ideas I'm generating, but actually there's a much bigger impact here than just what I'm doing. So that's a very kind of tricky subject. I'm not really sure how you tackle that. It just kind of depends on the philanthropic nature of whoever's developed it and how much they want to share their ideas. But yes, I'd be all for a kind of centralised depository of lots of good sustainable ideas.
And how would IPR work with that? Intellectual property rights.
Well, you'd have to share a process that wasn't kind of, you know, specifically kind of about ingenuity. So if you designed a unique disassembly fixing, that's still going to be kind of applicable to being patentable.
Yeah.
But then it's solely down to the company if you can persuade someone to open that up, or to, you know, you open that up in a way that you're just kind of sharing the knowledge and selling your element of it.
Yeah.
That's still a very kind of positive step.
And we've got great examples of that. Volvo's a really good example of sharing IPR, and there are many, many more recent ones.
I think, just very quickly to add, I think the challenge with those things also tends to be how you incentivize contribution to a resource such as that, because I'm sure many people would use that kind of resource. I know I would. But getting people to actually add to it, I think, is the other thing. And so there would need to be some kind of profiling so that it's seen as showcasing and celebrating good practice, I suppose, as a means to provide incentive. And I guess in terms of IPR, you would the posts or the entries or the examples would be seen as donations. You know, they would be people just donating their experience to a more collective idea of a field.
Just very quickly, I'd echo what Rich said in terms of the transparency side of things. We've discovered that, I mean, really, you want to find examples of design that work at scale, and when the big companies are involved, they don't really want to tell everyone about their failures, and actually we all learn from failures. So we're working quite hard to try and pull stories out of, you know, there are things going on, but people are very reluctant to talk about them. However, you said a community of designers where we could all learn, but I kind of strongly believe that it's not just designers. And if we stay in our design silo, then we'll miss out what's happening in other areas like material science or just understanding. Both Jonathan and Rich have talked about actually going to a landfill site or going to an end-of-life centre, and there are so many innovations happening in those areas as well. So that changes all the time. You know, there's new ways of disassembling or recycling. So in a way, you need to connect all those people together, not just designers. And last but not least, the winners of the Technology Strategy Board competition, there'll be 50 of them in all, and we're going to be using those as case studies. As part of the entry, you have to come up with a video, so we're going to be using those as kind of ideas and case studies and putting them online as well. That's one of our aims, is to do exactly what you asked.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested in the power that underlies this system. So a couple of the problems that I heard was that there's a poor brief, there are ill-equipped designers, and then the interesting thing that Rich was saying is that it sounds like the system incentivizes shredding rather than disassembly, and so it seems like there are three problems here. Who has the power in that relationship? It sounds like the designers got a lot of power because they lock in a lot of the characteristics of the product that they create. But it also sounds like the person doing the commissioning has a lot of power because they choose who the designer is. But maybe the system has the power because you can design the best product, but if it ends up in a shredder, it wasn't worth it.
Good question. Thank you. I will take three together, actually. Gentleman here.
Yeah, I'm glad I came after you, because the lock-in is the point I was going to make, because a designer is governed by the brief that he or she gets, and by the product that's been put out to the market and the affordability that we have for that product. We never think about the end life of that product at all. And I think the fact that we are thinking about it gives us an indication that there are so many products here that we have already on the planet that we cannot apply the circular economy to. And that would need a lot of addressing before we even think about circular economy. Because if you think about it, it was tried many times in China, for example, in the agricultural fields in China, and actually failed miserably because we have moved as a society to something very different, which is consumer society. And that's where we need to really address the issue about how we maintain or reduce our consumption. I'll give you another example. Solar panels. Everybody now in the UK could see solar panels. 5 years ago, you won't see many of them around. And in order for us to increase the efficiency of solar panels, we need to think about new materials. We need to think about new products and so forth. That in themselves create different problems. And you cannot think about those from the time you design it, because you discover in the lab that this material will give you a 2% more efficiency. But you don't think at the end what will happen to that after 35 or 50 years of life.
Brilliant, thank you. So the question I've got is how do we reduce consumption? I think I'm going to pick that bit out of all the things that you said, all good points. And then the woman behind.
Yes, I just support that comment because my model of sustainability design is in my kitchen. It's a Miele washing machine that I inherited from my mother, and it's 45 years old and it works perfectly well. We do not need new design for those things because we know very well how to make them. What is now being designed is how to make them to break. And I do agree that with modern technology, where we use completely different materials, we should put our design idea really into what materials they are and how they can be renewed. But for many, many, many things we have and use daily, and we buy new and throw them away after a year at best, we need not to bother. Brilliant. About that. We just need to make sure that people have liability to produce something that lasts, and then the consumer doesn't buy stuff that is rubbish.
Brilliant. Thank you. So our three questions. Firstly, who has the power in the relationship in terms of brief creation, designers, and then the system? How do we reduce consumption? And then how do we build longevity in? And if I may add a bit to that, how do we build longevity in and still make money? You know, how do corporations still make money from that?
Don't get me started on washing machines. My three-year-old John Lewis washing machine broke recently, and the three engineers that I rang said it wasn't worth fixing because the logic board had broken. And I did a bit of asking around, and basically any washing machine that has a logic board in it is not going to last very many years, whereas the older ones, the ones that relied more on kind of clockwork with fewer features, they can last forever. We were talking to a well-known consumer magazine recently, and they said that they are going to add in different criteria to, so normally you say, you know, here's three washing machines, right? This one washes your clothes very well. This one's got 17 different cycles for your knitwear, you know, and that's how you choose your washing machine. When you want to buy a new washing machine, you balance out price and model and, you know, how many functions it's got and all those kind of things. But they said they're going to start building in new criteria, and one of the criteria was how easy it is to fix and repair, and another criteria it was about whether the company take responsibility for it at the end of its life. And both those criteria were designed to be kind of stealth ways of changing consumers' mindsets, so getting us back into the idea of thinking about whether something can be fixed or repaired, which I think that people just have given up, actually. So you look at TVs, for instance, and we're being educated by marketing and advertising to want the next new flat-screen TV with the new features that we didn't have before, and that's where it gets tricky, that kind of slip into the electronics. Fast-moving electronics are the really dangerous area.
I completely get the point, but I also don't think there is such a thing as the consumer, because there's different types of consumer. I'm sure in this very room, you know, there are people who actually quite like new things, whether that's ethically sound or not. There are probably people in this room that really are not interested in new things at all and just want to keep what they've got for as long as possible. And then there are hundreds of other types of people. So there is no the consumer. There are different types of consumer. I think in terms of the 40-year-old?
45.
Sorry, 45. So if we don't talk about the energy efficiency and water consumption of that machine, which I'm guessing is pretty intensive, but we just talk about the principle of keeping something for longer, I think that's, of course, it's quite right. And I think that's quite a rare example of a person who's found a durable product and chose to stick with it. But I think, as I mentioned, you know, the idea of the consumer as a singular notion, I think it can be quite unhelpful because there are lots of different types of, you know, buying motives, and it also varies depending on the type of product as well. I'm sure for washing machines, probably most people in this room would be quite happy to stick with a durable, reliable model. In terms of smartphones, might change, you know, and it's very difficult, really slippery idea. But what's interesting is that I think you can design a washing machine that will probably last for 20 years or so, but designing one that people will want to keep for 20 years or so, I think, is a much tougher challenge. Because actually things like fascination and desire and attachment, and these are things that can break. These are things that can stop working, you know, in a kind of experiential sense. And so, yes, it is a puzzling kind of tricky area.
But that's where leasing and service comes back in. So yeah, the washing machine idea of where you have a washing machine and you are able to upgrade it when the next good feature comes along.
The interesting thing about Miele is, as I understand it, that they did used to make kind of bomb-proof washing machines that last for an incredible amount of time. I don't think that is true anymore. I think they've changed their construction. I think it is more digital now. And I would assume, that's mostly a kind of a profit motive, that, you know, they're competing in a crowded marketplace. Their only driver is to lower the cost or higher the price. So the driver for a manufacturer just isn't there to make something that will last for 40 years. Because, well, you know, if I could design something that lasts for 40 years and I sell, well, there's a million people, I sell a million washing machines and I don't sell any more for 40 years. Or I could sell a million of them and then sell them all again in 5 years' time. That's much more appealing. And the kind of what's interesting about both of these, so we've gone from kind of really fast-paced consumption ideas to the kind of the question of longevity, and they all fit quite nicely in the umbrella of closed loop, but in very different ways, because there's no kind of one size fits all. It's not about having a phone that lasts 40 years, because it's not really appropriate, because technology is moving so much faster than that. So, you know, the ideas of kind of leasing rather than ownership with a washing machine does solve that, because, well, then I have a motivation to make this last as long as physically possible. And the kind of reference, I used to use this reference of the old Kodak camera, explaining the kind of the driver for people to design things intelligently. So the little disposable Kodak cameras that, you know, everyone has, you take sort of 30 photos and send it back, and it costs £5. And it's actually, how are they making that camera so it costs £5? Well, they're doing it because they're selling that camera about 10 times. So you get a camera, you use the film, and you have to send it back to get developed. They're taking it apart, taking the film out, putting a new housing on the same body and selling it again. And it was a kind of quite a nice secret closed loop. But it meant you know, it was the clever business model of leasing rather than ownership that meant you could have a kind of more durable product and keep selling it.
And the word disposable was completely misplaced in that.
Yeah. Well, it was the user experience. Yeah. You know, you just gave it back, and it was no one really knew about that.
It was invisible.
That was quite nice.
Thank you. I can vouch for the change in build quality of that particular brand. 2 years, not 45. Very irritating. Really quickly, we're going to just answer the question was asked over here. Who carries the power in this big equation? Is it the brief writer? Is it the designers? Or is it the system?
I think the person with the best idea carries the power. You know, and best idea meaning something that satisfies what most people want,
but the problem
but
is
also
the,
edges things forward.
The system creator isn't talking to the brief writer. That there are big gaps in this.
And you've got, so when you say system of greater, it's kind of legislation is sitting there. Is that you've got the customers, the designers, and the legislation, and they all interact in very different ways. And you know, the legislation does drive how people behave and kind of common design practices, but that doesn't mean that there's not kind of, you know, people like Orange Box, when I went to visit them, they weren't responding to the legislation. They'd found a much better way of doing it themselves. So they'd come up with lots of kind of clever ideas to beat the system in a lot of ways. So, yes, it seemingly, if you kind of take it at face value, the system has power, but you know, with a bit of ingenuity, you can beat the system. But it does require the right briefs.
But a big change in the system on waste electricals would be the other IPR. I define the first one, individual producer responsibility. So when if Sony or whoever were getting their own thing back, maybe that would make a difference in the way they design things. Okay, got two more questions. Gentleman there with the beard.
I think I just wanted to ask why the most obvious solution seems to be off the table, which is that consumers just have to pay the cost of disposal.
My question is a bit more emotional, I guess. I mean, we're thinking about the systemic nature of things and manufacturing and supply and all of that sort of stuff. But the one problem that I always face is that how do you tackle convenience? People say, this is convenient, so I'm going to opt for option A instead of option B, which is a better solution with regards to disassembly, with regards to it being environmentally friendly. So how do you shift this behaviour change? How do you drive that?
That's about changing the design of the service, isn't it? I can see how leasing could aid convenience.
I don't know if leasing alone makes it convenient. I think there's this sort of a mental setup with a lot of people that you can't, at least I really struggle with it.
Is it convenience of the consumer or convenience of the designer? What's the
convenience of the consumer.
Okay,
brilliant. So, two questions. Why are we not talking about the consumer paying the cost of disposal, and how do we ensure that whatever we design is convenient for the consumer?
I think the convenient question was, how do we deal with the fact that people will tend to opt for the more convenient option? I suppose it's linked, isn't it? That question for me is really resonant, because that's something I'm grappling with at the moment. It tends to be this enduring thing. But I think when you look outside of, I don't know, say products, in the hard, shiny, plasticky variety, and we talk about a comparison between, say, a ready meal, although that is a product. But if we talk about a ready meal, and the convenience of that, and the experience of that, and the meaning of that, and the health of that. And we compare that with, say, a home-cooked meal, which is massively inconvenient, which if you think about it, you know, I've got to plan what I'm going to have, I've then got to go and get the things, I've then got to go and, you know, and there's so many stages, including cleaning up afterwards, and all of that. And yet, we all seem to understand the distinction between the two, and why sometimes it's better to do one or the other. And I think there's something about the fact that we've successfully exported the value of that to people. So it's just understood. It's just kind of known. And, I mean, you're in visual communication, and right? And you know, so you understand that more than anyone, perhaps, that idea that people need to, I think, understand where the value is in doing it this way as opposed to that way. Like, what's the difference? And I think it's just something we're historically quite bad at, exporting that value to people.
And it's going to depend on where you see convenience and where you get your pleasure from. It, to me, popping a knife in the film and putting it in the microwave, it might be convenient, but it's not living. Living is cooking food from scratch and hopefully from my garden. Okay, Nat, why aren't we talking about the consumer paying for the cost of disposal?
Well, I was just thinking about that, thinking, would that work? Quite a lot of people, when we were talking about e-waste, electronic waste in particular, most people confess to having a hallway full of a dead computer and a dead kettle, because even if you know what to do with it, then, well, especially if you don't know what to do with it, you put it in the black bin, but if you know what to do with it, it's kind of hard to find the right place to take it. Where I live, you have to take it to the Islington Council dump, but you can't cycle in there, and I don't have a car, so I'm caught in between. I think it works better when you incentivize the consumer to give back the rubbish. So, for instance, it's the classic deposit on a bottle. So I give my bottle back and I get 10p. And that always works. You know, San Francisco brought it in again a few years ago and it works. You know, the bottles go back. So I think rather than penalising the consumer who might just end up hoarding rubbish or illegally fly-tipping it, it'd be better to get the producer to pay that.
The Wii legislation that exists, that costs money to manufacturers. So if I sell a TV onto the market, I have to pay an amount into Wii legislation. And well, I'm not absorbing that cost, I'm just adding it to the price that the consumer pays. So, and that works in different countries. So maybe there is some kind of mental difference if I see the price and the recycling price, but it's still, for me, that just, it doesn't really solve the problem because it's still going to get collectively reprocessed. There's still going to be no motivation for me to change the design of that product. So it doesn't create any of those motivations to design something better.
Okay, we've got the last two questions.
Nika McDonald, a fellow of the Society. Mark, since you're the chair, but you made some points, I thought I might ask you a question.
Feel free.
A sheikh, I believe, in the 1970s, when talking about the oil crisis, said, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. The subtext is, what is a resource? Was oil a resource in 1850? Well, no, it was used for lighting up strange bits of the Middle East and Kazakhstan and those kind of places. So I think resources are things we discover as humans, clever people, and often we find uses for things that we thought we knew of, that we knew the uses for already. So I think you're being a bit unimaginative about resource limits. Nat, things that we don't want to throw away are nice. They tend to be quite expensive. There's a quote from Patek Philippe. Some people here might have one of these. It's a watch. You merely look after it for the next generation. You'd never actually own it. Now, I don't own one because I'm too poor, and most people here are as well. So if we're going to have these kind of products, maybe we should all be made richer by having better jobs and being paid better. Is that the corollary? I think it should be. Jonathan, designers shouldn't...
last one.
Shouldn't
okay.
carry the sins of others. I agree. But why are we focusing just on design in this debate? I know it's the Great Recovery. I know it's RSA design. But you cited the example of the 1930s and...
Planned obsolescence.
Now, there were other solutions to the depression in the 1930s. Most of them weren't planned obsolescence. Some of them were called socialism. Some of them were called communism. Some of them were called fascism. They were variously good and bad. But they were bigger economic solutions, not just talking about designers. We need to have that context of design at a society such as the RSA. And I think you're the man to bring it to us.
That's interesting. And I think the overriding context of monetarism and capitalism is why design has changed in the way that it has changed. And it will change back. I'm pretty certain about that. And you're right. Resources are only resources when you need them and when you know what you can do with them. And our next round of resources are out there already, and we just don't know they're there yet. So thank you for your point.
Design should be working in R&D and research and science. That would be an interesting debate.
And that's the whole, new and uses. That's the whole point of the Great Recovery Programme. There was a question over here in the corner as well. Thank you.
Hi. My question is about planned obsolescence. And there's this documentary that I saw recently, which is about a light bulb conspiracy. And it talks about basically a light bulb that has been burning continuously for 100 years. And it's really interesting that when the first time it was built, the engineers, they were sent back to the labs to redesign the product so it would last less time.
Yeah.
And the thing here is that we're in a system that... It's fed by mass consumption and mass production. So if we make objects that could last longer, I don't think it's a very positive idea, but will it actually be possible?
There's a big economic barrier. I can see that. But there's also big economic opportunities.
But the reality, it's this one.
It
so,
is.
I'm just wondering, because this is a question that I ask myself every day, and
something in common then.
I think we're all flummoxed with the same thing, and I guess smarter, more intelligent design, more emotionally led design, and leasing
changing in the way we own things and buy things is the answer. Well, there maybe will be no choice. We will have to change these things. There's a gentleman at the back. He's dead keen. I've said this the last one, but he's been dead keen to get a point in.
Thank you. One point I'd like to make is that designers do seem to like to wring their hands about this a lot, when actually I'm involved in a community repair initiative where our biggest problem is not the design, it's the manufacturers who no longer make spare parts. We have lovely examples of stuff which we can't repair because a gear wheel has worn out and they no longer make it.
Yeah.
And it's uneconomical to specially build one part.
Unless you've got a 3D printer. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, exactly.
We are seeing some solutions to that. I'm going to try now just if you could think about the three things you want us to do tomorrow. And I've had a question over Twitter. I don't know whether to ask it or not because I'm fed up of Apple, if I'm honest. But someone has asked, if Jonathan Ive was on the panel, what would his and Apple's contribution to be? And I guess we're nudging emotional obsolescence and planned obsolescence and technical obsolescence because there are no finer masters than some of the IT companies. So I'm going to leave you to answer that in your own heads. But if you could be thinking, if you could just put your hand up and give me some of the things that you want the RSA to take away and look at tomorrow morning. I'm just going to pick randomly. So if any of you have got a burning... Yes, that woman in the pink jacket.
How many washing machines does it take for you to get home in terms of energy and power and resource? And actually, I think that we haven't talked about the great issue, and that is our built environment. And most of the water, most of the power, most of the heat, most of the bad health, social issues, etc., are due to the bad design of our built environment. So I think if there's one thing I'd like you to look at,
yep,
is the bigger design, which I think impacts us a lot more. Are we putting all our energy into fine-tuning those products for 1% of the population?
Where are the big wins?
So, where is the honesty, integrity, and fairness in what you're doing?
So, brilliant, thank you.
One of the basics of good design is your moral motivation, good and bad design, and that we have to go back through history to before the Industrial Revolution and before people were making products en masse and trying to make money for money's sake.
Sorry to rush you, but what do you want us to do tomorrow?
Try and do more local food growing.
Local food, bingo, yes. Okay, local food growing, thank you. Gentleman right in the corner, I'll come to you.
My ask is, where are the new great redesigners of the economy, the new model economy?
Oh, that's a great question. Can we think about that one? Question here.
I'd like to suggest that the RSA starts to promote a new slogan. People are pretty familiar with the words, the polluter pays. Maybe we should start to say the designer pays. And what I mean by that is we actively promote closing the financial loop so companies with good design actually do make more money than those with linear supply chain designs. And at the moment, that loop's not closed, so the designer should pay.
So we do that for the tax system, maybe, or some kind of...
Whatever that means, but if we could get the idea of the designer pays,
yeah,
like we have got the idea of the polluter pays, that might be a start.
Brilliant. Okay.
Hello. I'd like to see the RSA look into the redesign of one of the most inefficient models and one of the most inefficient aspects of our households, the toilet. There's litres and litres of water, potable water, just flushed away every single day. And I think it was one of the most bizarrely designed models that we still use. And that I haven't really seen any kind of new developments.
Composting toilets for all. Thank you. I'll look after that one personally myself. And finally, over here.
I'm hoping it's an easy one and that you've probably maybe already done it together already. There's a curriculum review underway at the moment for the English curriculum, including design and technology. And I think that's a key area that we should really make sure that this type of thinking is embedded.
In education?
Yes.
Because education's a bit broken. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. I've got to draw the session to a close because we've run out of time, but I'd love to thank you all for coming. I'm so sorry that we didn't have a full panel, but I think you'll agree we had a great panel. So if you could thank the panel in the usual way.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.